Good afternoon. Welcome to this operational risk and regulation webinar on achieving Solvency II compliance while increasing business performance. My name is Alexander Campbell. I'm the editor of Operational Risk and Regulation magazine. And joining me for this webinar are Peyman Mesjian, managing partner at Chartis Research, Tony Boubier, the Europe, Middle East and Africa business analytics leader for insurance at IBM, and Rajon Besner, head of Solvency II implementation at Swiss Re. Thank you all very much for joining me. I think the best way to open this discussion is probably to ask the question that all our listeners will want to know about. What's the biggest single challenge that insurers in particular are going to face as a result of the introduction of the Solvency II rules? Peyman, perhaps you'd like to start this off.
Yes, so based on our research, you know, we survey many insurance companies and we talk to many CROs and Solvency II project leads. And the one area that consistently is cited as a obstacle to success is data. So this is primarily around data quality and data integrity and the overall accuracy and consistency of it. I think this is particularly important since data is foundational to the fair valuation of assets and projections, and ultimately the internal models for Solvency II rely on this information. It's a case of garbage in, garbage out, and part of this challenge is the sheer variety of data that needs to be brought into the various risk and finance calculations. So, you know, you're looking at transactional data, you're looking at claims data, you're looking at finance and risk data all being merged into supporting the calculations. So from our perspective, if, you know, I was to pick one area, it would be data management.
Thanks very much. Tony, what's, from your perspective, what do you think the biggest challenge is going to be? Is it going to be a technical issue? Is it going to be data, as Peyman said, or do you think it's the biggest challenge is going to be somewhere else?
Well, I guess really in the 5 or so years that IBM have been working on the Solvency II initiative, we've seen a number of challenges emerge, and certainly I'd agree with the previous speaker that data is certainly one of the key issues. But there are others. The challenge of cost, for example, technical integration, and I think also the difficulty of what seems to be a slipping time frame and all the uncertainty that seems to be going with that. Of course, you know, when you look at things across multiple geographies, you see different levels of maturity. Countries are moving at different paces. Companies are moving at different paces. And because of all that variation, it's becoming increasingly clear for us, or to us, that one solution really doesn't fit all requirements across the entire marketplace. But in terms of, I guess, the challenge, I'm going to be slightly cheeky, and I'm actually going to pick two. The first, for me, is the challenge of retaining interest and momentum in the Solvency II agenda. It feels like Solvency II has been in the headlines for maybe 4 or 5 years. People are beginning to feel a little battle-weary with Solvency II. So, you know, the challenge of keeping interest going and momentum is quite critical. And secondly, maybe the broader cultural issue of extending Solvency II beyond compliance, and not even just looking at capital optimization issues, but also the wider impact of Solvency II in the organization, how it will affect strategy, product design, and marketing. So on those two points, retaining interest and momentum and broadening the Solvency II agenda across the wider business.
Thanks very much, Rajon. You're actually in the business of Solvency II implementation yourself. What's been the biggest single challenge for you on going through the process of implementing these new rules?
Well, I think that all the points mentioned by the other two speakers are very valuable. I think these are all challenges that are being faced by by the industry. I think from our point of view, we had the advantage at Swiss Re of building from a foundation that we already had with the SST framework. So that made it a lot easier for us to tackle solvency too. But if I look at the industry in general, I would also add, and that's closely related, I think, to the question around data and producing and reporting good numbers at the end, but it's also all the business processes that are being put in place by companies in order to do the reporting and to do the various valuations that are required under Solvency II. And a lot of that work is going to have to be done at a time of the year where resources are busy with other types of reporting, be it GAAP or statutory. So all of that, I think, is adding a load on existing resources, and definitely, I think, will create a lot more operational risk in once Solvency II is implemented.
Okay, we've raised a lot of different topics there that I'd like to pursue in detail later on. But before we get into that, a lot of the debate around Solvency II has focused on seeing it as a kind of insurance equivalent of the Basel II capital rules that were brought in recently into the banking industry. Given that the banks were first into this swamp, in a sense, how much, if anything, do you think the insurance industry can learn from watching what's happened to the banking sector and watching how they dealt with the similar challenges that that Basel II imposed?
So from our perspective at Chartis, we definitely see some similarities between Solvency II and Basel II, but also there's some important differences. So on the similarities side of it, if we look at Basel II and Solvency II as a proxy for enterprise risk management, then there's some standard transformation and change management challenges that organizations face. Some of it is around, you know, as the other speakers have said, around people and culture and sponsorship and leadership from the top. And we saw where there was insufficient leadership in Basel II initiatives, then there were problems around implementation and adoption. Also, the data management challenge, I think, is common across both pieces of regulation. They both are very data intensive, and you know, that's a shared problem between the banking industry and the insurance industry. However, there are some methodological differences in Solvency II that should not be underestimated. From my perspective, I actually think Solvency II is more challenging from a modeling perspective. You know, clearly Basel II was about market risk, credit risk, and operational risk. But in Solvency II, we're also dealing with actuarial risks and insurance risk. Insurance risk includes a broader subset of risks such as reserving, premiums, reinsurance, extreme events, and product design. And these differences are non-trivial. And we have seen, particularly on the vendor side, some vendors assuming, because they had calculation engines that were appropriate for Basel II, applying them to Solvency II doesn't necessarily solve the problem. So that's one aspect that should not be underestimated. I think the final point I'll make on this, and I think it's relevant to one of the previous points, is Solvency II regulations are still moving. The goalposts are still being moved. There's still quite a lot of uncertainty around the detail and the deadlines. And that was also the case to some extent in Basel II. And we found some banks leaving it really too late before they started moving on the project. They were waiting for the regulations to be defined to the nth degree before they started investing. And they really ran out of time very quickly. And the project management became too challenging. So, you know, our recommendation around that is there's some fundamental building blocks that are required around particularly operational risk, you know, calculation, data management that I mentioned, and putting in place those fundamental building blocks should happen as soon as possible. Because regardless of what the detail turns out to be, you do need those building blocks, and they become accelerators to move fast when the regulations settle in terms of certification.
Tony, do you have anything to add to that? I mean, from the systems point of view.
Well, I think that's a really interesting perspective. Certainly, we looked at the Basel II pattern when we were developing our Solvency II solution, and there were very clear comparisons, not just in terms of the technology and the architecture and the data issues, but also the challenges of implementation. If anything, it taught us to be a little patient, insofar as that we felt from the outset there was a potential for time to slip, but we recognised equally that if organisations wait until the last minute to start their implementation, then almost inevitably there will be a bandwidth issue across the entire industry, and that's a real challenge. But I think the danger also is that, you know, we are often looking at this, or insurers are often looking at this as a compliance issue. You know, we've been banging the drum for a little while to suggest that really there is a very tangible business benefit in adopting some of the ideas which form part of the Solvency II approach, in terms of organizational change and the data management and all those issues. And it's quite interesting that not too many insurers seem to be looking beyond compliance at the moment, which for me is a little short-sighted. I think in terms also of the uncertainty of the final requirements, I think it puts an obligation on insurers to choose trusted partners, I think, rather than technology tools, recognizing that those partners will have some degree of flexibility and can work with the insurer along what for the moment seems a slightly uncertain journey.
Rajan, does that sound familiar from your experience? I mean, would you agree with that that description of how Solvency II is being treated? Have you seen that in the industry?
Well, I mean, obviously, being a pure reinsurer, we did not have direct experience with the Basel framework. I mean, certainly, we've tried to apply some lessons that seem to have been learned by the industry in general, particularly in terms of expectations from the regulators. I think in terms of the previous comments, I think I see both in the industry. I see companies that are trying primarily to achieve compliance. I see other companies that are taking this as an opportunity to significantly upgrade, I think, their capabilities, and particularly in terms of risk management. I think the challenge through that is at the end of the day, the requirements of Solvency II are fairly prescriptive. I think at the base, it's meant to be principles-based, but the specific requirements are very detailed. So as much as a company might want to use this as a way to improve the way they do business, the compliance aspect at the end of the day remains pretty critical because of the specific requirements and just cannot be ignored.
I'd like to look at the issue of treating this as a compliance exercise versus treating this as, if you like, an opportunity to optimize capital to improve risk management across the business. Now, the one thing that does occur is that everyone's operating in an environment of fairly tight budgets, and it's going to be a lot easier to make the case for Solvency II related spending if you can point to a concrete compliance requirement, say, look, we need this budget because we need to meet this requirement. This is a compliance requirement that we can't escape, versus simply saying we need this budget because we want to improve our risk management, improve our capital management in a more general way. How do you make the case for that kind of spending, for that kind of investment, if not by pointing to the need to comply?
Well, maybe if I pick up on this one first. So we're beginning to see a slight shift in the positioning of the compliance debate, and seeing compliance and Solvency II as really being part of a financial transformation of the Office of Finance. So, you know, we recognise that many of the tools which are required, including the data governance and management to satisfy solvency, are equally valid in terms of the other regulatory requirements, IFRS, but also the effective management of an insurance business. I think because of that, we begin to see a shift away from focus on the cost of compliance into the business value of transformation. Recognizing that, you know, it's a much more complex environment nowadays than probably ever before. Can happily debate that point. But fundamentally, you know, we see a successful compliance environment very much being one where the insurance company has its finger on the pulse across the entire organization. And using the foundations of Solvency II and compliance to make big corporate decisions around, for example, buying or selling businesses, growing, contracting, specializing or generalizing. But fundamentally, you know, we see all the capabilities which will come out of the back of Solvency II compliance leading to an insurance industry which is much more agile in decision making, and that agility has a real tangible value.
Sorry if I was going to pick up on that. I mean, I totally agree. I mean, I in a way, maybe it's not that important why companies are doing it. I think the important thing is that it is giving them the opportunity to change the way they do business. And I doubt that a lot of companies would have been willing to make that kind of investment up front if it wasn't because of a requirement from a compliance point of view. But I think often they are taking the opportunities to see this as a way to improve the way they manage, and I think they buy into the idea, and I totally agree. I mean, I think that's going to, in the end, I mean, there'll be a lot of upheavals, I think, caused by the introduction of Solvency II. You know, there'll be consolidation most likely, and other things we'll see in the industry, but I think in the end it will be a stronger industry. I think it's all positive. I mean, Swiss Re has been a strong supporter of the concept of Solvency II for, you know, from the very beginning, and we still continue to believe in the merits of the framework.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with both of those points, and also I would add to it that beyond the business benefits in terms of better decision-making, risk and finance integration, and, you know, risk-based performance management, the points have been made, I think there is a reputational benefit as well from compliance. Particularly in the current climate, I think trust and confidence in financial institutions is low. And I think if you can show that you've got advanced approaches in terms of corporate governance and meeting advanced requirements from the regulators, it's almost like a stamp of trust. It shows that there's rigorous risk management systems in place, and I don't think that should be underestimated. The reputational impact will increasingly be more and more important, particularly in Europe. And I would add that to the business case, you know, add it to the points already made.
Is this going to affect the decision of, whether to be an early or a late adopter? And this is a topic that more than one of you has raised already, the issue of the timescales being fairly long and also fairly uncertain, and that this is making it difficult for companies to make that decision, and it's leading to a lot of them delaying it. How should they have been acting in terms of early or late adoption of these standards? What areas should they have been concentrating on first, even before the standards have been firmed up?
Well, I mean, I would comment on this, that early adoption of what? You know, again, if we sort of take away the fixation on compliance for a second and think about the spirit of the regulation, which is better risk management and better governance and more transparency, then actually the early steps are, you know, you don't need to do everything at once. So I think insurance companies need to think of an overall blueprint before starting. You know, what is the target state in terms of systems, architecture, processes, organizational structure? And that can be defined now. That should be defined now, even if there was no Solvency II regulations. And once that blueprint is defined, there's no need to do everything once. There's certain, as I said, certain fundamental components for good risk management that should be in place. So, you know, specifically around, for example, the area of operational risk, which we want to talk about, you know, every firm should have risk and control self-assessment processes. You know, every firm should be collecting loss data. You know, every firm should be going through scenario analysis and stress testing, regardless of whether there's a Solvency II deadline or not. That's just good business practice. And then using that information to support decision-making and embedding it into, you know, day-to-day activities. So those kind of steps, there should be no waiting for, and, you know, they should be adopted as a leading practice, and should then facilitate and accelerate the process of compliance.
But I think we fail to, you know, recognize that it's a competitive world out there, and, you know, organizations, of course, have to do this from a compliant point of view. But to what degree can insurers who are early movers obtain competitive advantage from the steps they've taken? Certainly, you know, we spoke at the top of the call about the importance of data and data governance and data management, which is almost a hygiene factor in reality. You know, these are things which should have been on the agenda, I guess, really from the outset. And it's taken Solvency II and compliance to provide that catalyst, almost to make the industry do things which, in reality, you know, as the previous speaker said, we should have been doing all along.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I like the term catalyst because Solvency II definitely has been that. And in that respect, it's again, it's a very positive development. So, there are advantages and disadvantages. I mean, obviously, if you're taking a strict compliance view, I think if we had the data to study it, it may well be that the people that are late adopters of Solvency II also happen to be the ones that are focused more on compliance as opposed to improving the way that they do business. The other side of the coin, of course, is that for the early adopters, I mean, again, at the end of the day, it's all great to improve the way we do business, but we still have to be compliant, and being compliant means being in line with the requirements, and that's the frustrating part, I guess, is to not know exactly what we need to be compliant with, because that affects a lot of the systems work that we need to do in order to be able to, again, do the valuations and produce the reporting.
So I think on the whole, you know, I'm seeing certainly the Tier 1 insurers tending to be moving relatively more quickly than the Tier 2 and Tier 3. And certainly I'm seeing different behaviours in the Tier 2 relative to Tier 1. But there is potentially an argument for waiting, insofar as that I'm seeing new ideas coming out, particularly around the reporting layer, the Pillar 3 reporting, which might potentially drive down the cost of compliance.
New ideas coming out from where?
Well, I'm seeing a number of organisations thinking in terms of shared services, the ability to create accelerators, for example. I think that's a reflection of, you know, partly the panic which was beginning to emerge before the regulator slipped the timing again. But, you know, certainly if compliance is to some degree a moving feast, I think also that the industry and the technology industry as well is beginning to be more innovative in terms of the way to satisfy the industry requirements.
I'd just like to... Sorry, go on.
Sorry, I was going to say, I think... I mean, I agree with that to some extent, but I think the real capability that is required to meet both short-term tactical requirements as well as long-term strategic business requirements is to have flexibility. And that's flexibility across the board, flexibility in the technology architecture and systems and modeling tools and financial tools and so on, but also flexibility in terms of the project structure and organizational structure. So to create the agility so that, you know, the right steps are taken today, but create options in terms of execution. Things will change, you know. And by the way, you know, Solvency II will happen, and then there will be Solvency III. Look at Basel. We're into Basel 2.5, Basel 3, and so on. So I think building the flexibility at an organizational level as well as a systems level is ultimately the key success criteria.
And turning that around, so what are the most likely mistakes that insurance companies will make that will, if you like, tie them into an inflexible setup? I mean, okay, maintaining flexibility is important. What's it important to avoid doing if you want to remain flexible?
I think on the modeling side, you know, we've already seen, even some of the earlier, we've seen some of them taking a very much a black box approach in terms of calculations. And, you know, a one-size-fits-all approach, in some cases taking off-the-shelf solutions from the market, which are okay for a year or two, but then very soon, you know, they lose acceptability. So, you know, you need more of a open architecture, a toolkit approach. We've seen underestimation of the data challenge. Again and again we see that. And, you know, a typical, you know, Solvency II implementation project, you know, based on our research, anywhere between 60 to 70% of the effort is around getting the data ready. We've seen too much time spent on Pillar 1 and not enough on Pillar 2. And, you know, underestimation of the Pillar. You know, Pillar 2 is all about embedding and, you know, stress testing and the governance structures. And sometimes the mathematics of the Pillar 1 attract certain people within insurance companies, and they lose sight of the governance processes. So those will be the sort of areas that need to be thought about and create flexibility around.
The way companies are implementing Solvency II is very important. I mean, if they're adding another layer of systems and processes on top of what they already have in place, then that hardly supports the ability to be flexible and nimble in the market. And that's what some companies are unfortunately doing. Solvency II, I think, is clearly an opportunity to try to integrate the requirements with existing other valuation and reporting processes, and there I think there could be a significant benefit. I think that can pay off hugely, I think, for the company. Otherwise, I think you end up in situations where you may be getting some information out of your capital model that may be difficult to reconcile with what you're seeing under another view, maybe a gap view, and people will use time to try to reconcile that, as opposed to you know, being able to go ahead and make the right business decisions on the spot.
So I think maybe it depends on the ambition of the insurance company. you know, maybe the insurer, some insurers simply have an ambition to cross the compliance line. And then if they can reuse some of those capabilities a little later on, that's fine. I guess really the real challenge is that, you know, Solvency II is, I guess, almost a transformational moment for the insurance industry. But how many insurers actually see that? I think one day we'll look back and we'll say, you know, we were there when Solvency II happened, because, you know, the insurance industry was never quite the same again, for those who, of course, successfully implemented it. But, of course, for those organisations who choose the tactical route, purely compliance, I think it's almost inevitable that as they try to broaden out the value of all the work they've done into the different departments in the organisation, they'll find simply that the tactical decisions they've made won't allow them to scale across the entire enterprise. And they'll probably have to think in terms of perhaps retooling or choosing new capabilities.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that's where the early movers, I think, have a strategic advantage. I think they'll be ready. They'll understand the framework. It'll be properly embedded, and they'll be able to see other people reacting differently in the market, moving a bit more slowly and finding themselves in more difficult positions later on. And giving them the opportunity to take advantage of that.
If I can, I'd like to look specifically at the operational risk aspect. Now, more than one person's mentioned already that, of course, insurers should be doing these things already. They should be doing scenario analysis. They should be using internal and external loss data and so forth. Of the operational risk management requirements that are included in Solvency II, where do you think insurers will have the most ground to make up? I mean, which of these tools has been neglected, if you like, so far, and which ones are already being widely or almost universally used?
From my perspective, what we're seeing in the marketplace, the adoption, first of all, before we move to tools, in terms of methodology, I think the methodology that we see more than anything else is the loss distribution approach for calculating capital requirements. So, which requires obviously collection of loss data and then creating some level of adjustment by assessing the control environment. VAR analysis. So that, you know, that's to understand unexpected loss. However, where we've seen it more strategically, so that's really the loss distribution approach is really to address compliance requirements. But by putting the right processes in place in terms of control assessments and data collection and reporting, and in some cases using scenario analysis and key risk indicators to provide additional data, it's the net improvement in expected loss which often gives the business case for investing and having best practices around operational risk. So I think it's important to make the distinction between expected loss and unexpected loss and understand why systems and technology investments are being made from an overall enterprise risk management perspective.
Do you think that's a distinction that is easily made, that'll be generally understood in the industry?
I think so. I'm seeing more and more business cases in terms of justifying the cost of investment being based on reduction of expected loss. And then so that's the center of the sort of business case, and then, you know, to the side of the business case is, of course, having collected this data, we can then model and predict unexpected loss by combining internal data and external data, for example, to come up with a capital number. So, where I've seen the business cases being purely in terms of for modeling and capital adequacy requirements, then then often it's tactical tools buying as opposed to strategic process and integrated risk management investments.
Yeah, I think that highlights again the dilemma between compliance and sound business practices. I mean, clearly companies have advantage at understanding the expected the distribution they have around expected loss for operational risk and to manage that effectively to reduce those expected loss. Whereas Solvency II pushes you more towards the unexpected in terms of capital requirement. So you have to provide for that in terms of the from a compliance point of view, whereas the real value is around managing and reducing the risk.
And so I'd like to look at things maybe slightly from a different angle, insofar as that I believe the whole Pillar 2 issue and operational risk will put more focus back on the business in terms of how it manages its affairs, really. We spoke a little about reputational risk earlier. And, of course, failure in that area has a capital impact. But for me, one of the big challenges is that solvency and compliance and risk still seems to sit very much in the Office of Finance or with the larger organisations, with the CRO or various other risk-orientated analysts. But I think when you think that the impact of Solvency II will extend to multiple parts of the business, and of course that applies to the operational risk issue as well, how many marketeers or product developers have any inkling of really what Solvency II will mean for them? It seems to me really that the industry in its broadest sense has to embark on quite a wide educational journey and take Solvency II outside the Office of Finance and make other parts of the business recognise the impact and the importance.
Rajan, do you have anything to add on that? Which areas do you think the industry, which areas of operational risk management do you think the industry will need to do most catching up on? Which areas are underused at the moment that we brought in to force under Solvency II?
Well, again, I think as I said earlier, it depends which hat I'm wearing. If I'm from the business management point of view, I want to have a framework in place where I can control my operational risk, and which obviously needs data to support that. But if I think of compliance, then I think the challenge is really how do you determine the capital requirement for operational risk? How do you determine these extreme events that are capital events? That's a science that's really evolving at this point in time. So there are a number of approaches that one can take, and I don't think any of them are really proven at this stage. So that's a challenge for companies in terms of deciding which way to go initially, understanding that it's really the beginning of a process and that this will most certainly evolve a lot in the future.
If we can now, I'd like to go back to one of the challenges that Tony raised at the start of this discussion, which was the issue of culture, and I think this is an interesting discussion to have. I'd like to ask him to start it off by talking about what he thinks the most important cultural changes will be if he compares the industry as it is now, or the industry as it was 2 years ago, with a post-Solvency II insurance sector. What are going to be the most noticeable cultural differences there?
Maybe if I tell you just for a moment about my background. I spent many years working for insurers and intermediaries before I moved over to the technology sector. And I discovered that the insurance community and the technology sector often use different language to talk about the same thing. And it's the lack of understanding of each other's language which creates many of the challenges and barriers. And when we then look at the Solvency II issue, you know, we think in terms also of Solvency II jargon, words and expressions, portfolio replication, all these sort of issues which many insurance professionals don't actually understand and don't recognise the relevance. So I think maybe one of the interesting cultural issues will be, and it comes back to the earlier point I made on education, that we need to start using a language in this compliance transformation environment, which is understandable by all. Because once we start all speaking the same language, then we will be able to implement that cultural change much more effectively. I think while we use specialist language, which only a few people perhaps can really fully define or describe, then the whole topic of solvency remains in the hands of specialists. And it's far too important for that.
If I can throw that open to the other two, Rajan, what about you? Would you agree with that? That if you, a change in language and a change in accessibility is going to be the biggest difference that Solvency II is going to produce in terms of culture, or are there other cultural changes you'd like to bring out as well?
I think it's clearly a factor, but for me, the most important change is really establishing the connection between risk taking and business performance. I mean, this is just not a culture, I think, that's still broadly in place in the industry, and I think that Solvency II, of course, is pushing that very extensively. I mean, I see it, I look at what is in place here at Swiss Re, where we have been managing the business on economic principles for many years, and that really triggers significant change in the culture of the company. So to me, that's the biggest factor.
Payman, what would your take on the cultural issue be?
I would tend to agree with Rajan. I mean, we're definitely seeing more and more projects where there's a convergence between the risk discipline and the finance discipline, and moving towards risk-adjusted performance management. So, and you know, that's non-trivial. You know, a lot of the finance functions and finance professionals, their training is based on accounting, which is primarily a backward-looking science in terms of what happened, and reporting what happened. Whereas risk is forward-looking in terms of what is likely to happen and is probabilistic, and that actually touches on the language barriers. I've been in meetings where we've got finance and risk and business people using the same words, but each of them meaning different things, because there's no consistency, there's no standardization of definitions across the industry or even within the organizations themselves. So I agree with both of those points, but then one term that's overused, I think, is around integration of risk and finance and integration of systems. I'd like to sort of point from a cultural perspective towards more alignment. I think we need better alignment between the business lines, the front office, the back office, the risk and finance functions. And part of that creation of that alignment is around using consistent metrics and sharing information and communicating risk in a consistent way throughout the organization. But my final point on the cultural question is where I have seen the best initiatives, whether it's Solvency II or just risk management or ERM, is where the leadership, and this is at board level, there's been clear visibility of leadership from board level and sponsorship of the programs, and then that trickles down and that sets the tone for the whole organization. And I think that the leadership and board sponsorship components should not be underestimated.
Yeah, if I may add to that, I mean, I would agree, but also I think it's critical. I mean, we talk about finance and risk, but it's critical to bring the business on board also. And that will only happen clearly if there's very strong support at the highest level. level. And I mean, it's critical for success. I mean, you cannot implement a new vision of the business if the business itself is not in line with it.
It's particularly that's true because, as you were saying, Rajan, it's a the process of implementation is going to be a large burden on existing resources. You bring in a new system that's going to involve a lot of costs in terms of budget and in terms of manpower. It's also going to involve a lot of operational risk simply because this is a large change management process, the large change for the organization, and that's inherently a risky step to take.
Agreed.
If I can,
I think when we discuss the issue of leadership, my sense is that many boards, many leaders became quite upset at the cost of compliance, particularly around the data management. I think there was a fair degree of underestimation in terms of what needed to be done and also the time involved. And that started putting quite a lot of pressure on budgets and cost. So on the one hand, you know, we're trying to encourage the C-level to look beyond compliance and think about the return on investment. But on the other hand, you know, the executives have already had their fingers slightly burnt around cost, and then perhaps start making cost-cutting decisions, which were those tactical decisions we spoke about earlier. And in making the tactical decision, miss the opportunity to leverage the benefit of all that time and money spent on data governance earlier on.
Are there again? I mean, I'm going back to the banking issue again here, to the comparison with the banking sector. But in terms of managing this change, this large implementation project, are the lessons that the insurance industry can learn from the banking industry specifically here? Payment, you any way in which banking case studies, for example, can be informative for the insurance industry in terms of how to do it, how not to do it?
Yeah, I mean, to add to the previous points made, based on all the projects that I've seen, actually, the earlier you start, the better. Don't let compliance drive every decision. You know, do think of the business benefits. And then, you know, it's about data and people all the time.
So it's interesting, you know, when we compare the insurance industry with the banking industry. And, you know, on the one hand, bankers and insurers don't always get on. Maybe that's an overstatement, but they view themselves as being two quite distinct organisations, or two quite distinct industries. But you know, as we did when we started our Solvency II journey, we looked at the banking industry to see what had happened in Basel II and what lessons we could learn. And I think we definitely took some learning from that as an industry. And I think that the banking industry will, in its time, also look to the insurance industry to see how Solvency II was implemented, what lessons could be taken from that sector. So there are similarities, you know, between the banking and insurance sectors. And there are also differences, but I think there's a lot of knowledge transfer which has taken place already and which will continue to take place.
Thank you very much. We started this discussion by listing the biggest challenges for insurers as a result of the implementation of Solvency II rules. I'd like to see if we can wrap it up, see if we can summarise the ground we've covered by asking you each to list your what you think the largest single benefit for the insurance industry of Solvency II will be, and if you want to cheat and list more than one benefit, then by all means go ahead. Payman, if we could start with you again.
Okay, so I mean, you know, despite the challenges, I strongly believe that implementation of Solvency II should be viewed by insurers as an investment for the long term, rather than simply a box-ticking exercise for compliance. I think insurance companies can take the opportunity to create an enterprise-wide risk management system with a consistent data platform and good quality risk and finance information to support better decision making and ultimately, you know, improve performance. And clearly, there's a trade-off between short-term tactical compliance decisions, which are dependent on specific regulations, and there's a balancing act between that and the long-term strategic. And that is the challenge. But, you know, based on my business education, it's the companies that have a long-term strategic view of the world that ultimately win. The short-term tactical companies, you know, run out of oxygen sooner or later.
Thank you, Tony. What about you? What would you pick as the biggest benefits that the insurance industry can look forward to?
I mean, it's difficult to argue with any of the points of the previous speaker. I guess really the topic of today's discussion is around sovereignty and compliance, but we need to raise our eyes beyond that and think of a world beyond compliance and. I guess really how the industry will look in that post-Solvency II age. I think everything we're doing will lead to insurers becoming more informed, better managers of risk, but particularly much more agile than they ever were before. And in this very difficult, very challenging marketplace that we all operate in, the ability to make agile, correct, informed decisions will create an absolute competitive advantage.
Thank you. Rajan, perhaps you'd like to wrap this up. You've got a very good perspective on this. What would you say the biggest benefits that you are looking forward to at Swiss Re as a result of once the Solvency II process is complete?
Well, first of all, I would definitely agree with the comments that have already been made. I think those are very valuable. I think, again, for Swiss Re, Solvency II is more evolutionary than a revolution, because we've already been managing the business on economic principles supported by a strong risk management framework. So the additional benefits of Solvency II are perhaps less than what you might find in other organizations, but nonetheless, there are still benefits that we're gaining. For example, I think in terms of the ORSA process, which we're finding as an organization, and certainly the board of directors of our European entities are finding to be a very good tool to support their decision making. So again, I think at the end of the day, for me, it's the connection between risk-taking and business decisions. I think the industry has the opportunity to be in a much stronger place in terms of being able to understand the impact of their business decisions on their risk profile and their capital requirements, or the capital that they should be holding to in line with the level of risk taking that they want to take. I mean, I think what we have currently until Solvency II is implemented are very blunt tools in terms of making that connection, and Solvency II is a huge step forward in that respect, and can only result, I think, in a sounder industry.
Thank you very much. Well, that brings our discussion today to an end. I'd like to thank all three of my guests this afternoon: Payman Mestian, Managing Partner from Chartis Research; Tony Boubier, the Europe, Middle East and Africa Business Analytics Leader for Insurance at IBM; and Rajon Besner, the head of Solvency II implementation at Swiss Re. We have more in-depth coverage of the Solvency II debate and the implementation of the new standards online at our website, www.risk.net. But in the meantime, thank you very much for joining me.